You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, how do you find a new band or song to listen to? We'll talk about the artificial intelligence technologies on things like Spotify playlists and YouTube recommendations and how they're changing the way we discover music. Now, Iran elected a new president on Friday, Ebrahim Raisi. On Monday, President-elect Raisi said that Iran would not give up its development of ballistic missiles and that he would not meet with President Biden. Raisi made these comments as efforts are underway in Vienna to renegotiate the Obama-era nuclear deal. Under that 2015 agreement between seven countries, Iran agreed to limit its development of nuclear weapons. In 2018, then-President Trump abandoned the deal. President Biden faces a tough road to get it back on track. You could join in on at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on U.S.-Iran relations? How should the U.S. work on nuclear non-proliferation in Iran? Should that be a big U.S. priority? Do you want to see that Obama-era deal come back, or did you see problems with it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Rupal Mehta is an associate professor of political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and the author of Delaying Doomsday, The Politics of Nuclear Reversal. Rupal, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, it's a rocky road, clearly, on this deal. Based on where we are, new president of Iran, these negotiations going on in Vienna. What do you think the prospects are that we come back to an effective agreement?
I'd say the prospects are pretty mixed. For one, I mean, I think that there's been a lot of constructive conversations under the new administration in Vienna. But ultimately, from the Iranian perspective, most of these decisions are made at the supreme leader's level, at the Ayatollah Khomeini's level. So the new president probably won't have a lot to say that is not directed from the Ayatollah himself. So assuming that the Ayatollah is willing to continue with these conversations, I'd say we're on track to at least have a somewhat productive negotiation, but a lot of it will really just be a test of time and the strength of the negotiators at the table.
There is this new president in Iran. There was an election. I'm throwing some little air quotes on that because the religious leaders of the country kind of pick and choose who the candidates get to be. The choice of this president, Raisi, does that send a message about how willing the leaders of Iran are to come back to the table and work on this?
I actually think it sends a more interesting and potentially more important message about the Iranian public. With only about a 49% turnout for this election, which is dramatically lower than the 2017 election, which actually had a moderate come to power, former President Rouhani. I think what this suggests is that given the slate of candidates that were approved by the Supreme Council and the Ayatollah, this was the best of the options available, but certainly suggests that there's not a strong appetite for hardline politics in Iran, especially if it comes at the cost of more increased punishment through economic sanctions.
We're talking to Rupal Mehta, author of Delaying Doomsday, The Politics of Nuclear Reversal. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Looking at Iran, the U.S., and nuclear negotiations, you can join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rupal, I want to look at the initial Obama-era deal. One of the big criticisms from Americans, conservatives in particular, was that, okay, yes, it tackled nuclear weapons, but it didn't get into things like ballistic missiles or Iran's support of terrorist organizations, especially in the Middle East. As someone yourself who has studied this idea of nuclear reversal, should we be getting those other issues mixed into our nuclear weapons negotiations?
I definitely understand the perspective that having to tackle those issues would be great. Obviously, I think everyone wants to see a more safe and stable region in the Middle East. But tackling on some of these other issues, especially ballistic missile production or support for non-state actors, is really tough when you're already dealing with something as contentious as nuclear weapons. I think from most perspectives, focusing on the single issue was the only way that we were going to see any traction. And I think even going into the next iteration of a deal, it's probably going to be true that we're going to have to limit the scope of the negotiations in some part. But I take the point that this is something we all want to be working on. And so hopefully future discussions can focus on ballistic missiles or on support for non-state actors.
With the original deal as constituted until it was overturned in 2018 under the Trump administration, from what we can tell, Rupal, was it working? Was it keeping Iran further away from developing nuclear weapons?
Yeah, the best of our intelligence and our knowledge coming from both parties to the agreement, which is the United States, members of the P5, the permanent members of the UN Security Council, as well as international organizations like the International Atomic Energy Agency and relevant interested parties like Israel, all show that the deal was working, that Iran was complying with the agreements and limiting its production of nuclear-related materials and infrastructure. So it was a bit of a disappointment to almost everyone involved that the deal was abrogated. So that's a good sign. I mean, I think that the fact that the deal was actually being adhered to during the short amount of time that it was in play is actually a very good sign.
Now, you started that answer, though, with as far as we know. Was there enough, I guess, verifiability, transparency in that deal to where we could be pretty sure that Iran wasn't doing something kind of behind the curtains?
Well, I definitely don't have any access to classified information, but from what I can tell from all the open source data, from all of the transcripts and reports from the United States, from the other parties of the agreement, from the IAEA and other international organizations that were focused on exactly that point, they seemed satisfied with the transparency of the regime and its adherence and compliance with the agreement.
I want to look at the motivations for a country, especially a non-superpower country, when it comes to the question of whether or not to develop nuclear weapons. And I've heard the argument that countries might look at Libya and Muammar Gaddafi didn't get nuclear weapons and he's dead. Iraq, Saddam Hussein's dead. North Korea, Kim, is alive. Is there an existential justification argument for a country, say an Iran-sized country, to say, you know what, it's worth it to have this deterrent?
That's certainly one of the arguments that especially the academic scholarship and some of the policy community have been basing their understanding of these programs on. If you look at just the historical record, it seems like rogue actors, especially those that don't have robust, superior conventional or nuclear capabilities, are often vulnerable to foreign imposed regime change or other types of attacks in the international system. I think if you were to gather intelligence from Kim Jong-un or from other actors that are interested in nuclear weapons, they would cite those examples of Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein as reasons for why they themselves wanted nuclear weapons. I think for other countries in their position, it's a question of power, it's a question of resources, it's a question of prestige, and maybe even pressure from within the military to want to develop this very expensive but very lucrative type of technology.
A lot of these negotiations, I mean, key players here, Iran and the United States, and both countries have a lot of reasons not to trust each other. Iranians point toward a CIA-backed regime change in the mid-1900s and support for the Shah of Iran. Americans think back to the hostage crisis of the late 1970s. How do you overcome that kind of lack of trust between two key parties in this kind of negotiation?
It's very tough, and it's definitely not made easier by particular parties unilaterally withdrawing from an otherwise operating and productive agreement. I think the key here, though, is to increase information transparency, to work to show that over time there's lengthy periods when all the parties are agreeing to the agreement and they're complying with the agreement, and then ensuring that even if there is regime or party change within a particular country, that the successors to those that signed or ratified this agreement also uphold it. I think it's just a matter of time to really convince other parties, even our allies, that we're serious about this agreement and that we're going to remain committed to it as long as the other parties themselves are complying.
Rupal Mehta is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and author of the book Delaying Doomsday, The Politics of Nuclear Reversal. We're looking at the U.S., Iran, and nuclear negotiations. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you see President Biden approaching relations with Iran compared to his predecessors? In your read of it, do you think the Obama-era deal with Iran aimed at delaying nuclear weapons development in that country was a good idea? Or were you happy when President Trump got out of the deal, in effect, in 2018? Call in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Rupal Mehta. She is an associate professor of political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and the author of the book Delaying Doomsday, The Politics of Nuclear Reversal. We're looking at Iran and the U.S. and nuclear negotiations, a deal under the Obama administration, repealed the deal under the Trump administration, in effect, and some talks still underway, a new administration in the U.S., now a new president, for what it's worth, in Iran. You could join in with your questions, your thoughts, hopes, or fears about a new deal. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Rupal, could you point toward any countries in the past where we've had successful nuclear reversal that might give us lessons, a roadmap here as we talk about Iran?
Yeah, there's actually been a few. In fact, many more countries have successfully reversed their nuclear programs at various different stages of production. So they do provide a good, I think, roadmap for us. I think the most prominent and the most famous is probably South Africa, where after they developed and built an operational nuclear weapons program, they then dismantled it and gave up many of the component parts of it to the international community, specifically to the IAEA and other actors to ensure that they were now non-nuclear. But we also have instances of other countries that started and began a program but didn't complete it, including Australia, Switzerland, Sweden, Norway, where, you know, we were basically providing them with a series of carrots and sticks to ensure that they didn't want to pursue nuclear weapons. Some of those incentives were military assistance or economic assistance, other types of goodies that would make the deal sweeter, so to speak. And some of the sticks that we were using, especially with non-allies or adversaries or opponents of the United States, were threats of preventive military force or economic sanctions like the ones that we've seen imposed against Iran recently.
Should we have sanctions in place against Iran in the meantime? This is a key sticking point in negotiations leading up to 2015 and negotiations now.
Yeah, and it's a really tough one. I think one that has continued to sort of be the cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy. One argument for having sanctions is that it does cripple the regime a little bit, enough to want to come to the negotiation table. Whether or not it actually delays any nuclear progress is another issue. And from all the evidence we've been able to gather, me and many other academics, we don't see a lot of evidence that economic sanctions actually prohibit progress on a nuclear program. But what it does do is encourage leaders to want to speak to the international community and engage with the international community in an attempt to get those sanctions reversed. And in fact, one of the biggest sticking points in the current or the most recent Iranian election, where we saw now President Raisi win, was the fact that the United States had reinstated economic sanctions against the Iranians, which has now been one of the main parts of now President Raisi's interest in engaging or at least speaking a little bit with the United States, is to get those economic sanctions reversed.
And that seems like a sticking point in these Vienna negotiations. If I understand correctly, Iran says, hey, drop these sanctions, then we talk. And the Biden administration says, start talking, and then we'll drop the sanctions. Is that about where we are right now?
It's all, that's exactly where we are. And it's a pattern that we keep seeing repeated. And this is also true with the North Koreans. This is true in a lot of other contexts where we see actors engage in nefarious or poor behavior. We sanction them to try to get them to stop the behavior, but they won't stop the behavior unless the sanctions are lifted. And this is especially concerning, or especially, I think, important and interesting in this case, because the now president of Iran, President Raisi, is actually a specific target of economic sanctions from the United States. So that's going to be a really important issue for the negotiators to navigate or to muddle through. One would be to have legislation or some sort of guide frame or that basically allows for the sanctions to be immediately snapped back if there were to be an abrogation of an agreement. But even that's really tricky, in part because, again, these sanctions don't really impede progress. Mostly what they do is target elites or members of the population to encourage them to want to comply with the agreement.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Todd is with us from Michigan, driving now in Wisconsin. Todd, hello.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
What do you want to bring up, Todd?
I have a question. You know, it's regarding the nuclear, you know, deal with Iran. I think it's too late now to contain Iran because, you know, this step, it should be done since 2006. It's too late now. I guess, you know, Iran is very capable, you know, right now to make the nuclear bomb. So I think the only pressure we can put on Iran is, you know, the sanctions. And, you know, try to also put some pressure on Iraqi government, you know, because they have a lot of funds goes through, you know, Iraq, you know, matter of fact.
Todd, thanks a lot for the call. So the barn door is being closed after the horse is out of the barn, it sounds like, Rupal. Is Iran too far advanced to really matter what we do with negotiations now?
I don't think so. I think that one of the clear principles from the Obama administration and the other members of the Iran nuclear deal from 2015 was that we still had time. There was still an opportunity to stop this from happening. And I think that that's still true today. Certainly, we have months to try to stop this. And even if the barn is out of the horse is out of the barn already, we certainly have an opportunity to disincentivize the use of nuclear weapons, even if they're used to coerce or to deter other adversaries in the region or to threaten adversaries in the region. There's still a lot of work that can be done through diplomacy.
Thanks a lot for that call, Todd. We're talking to Rupal Mehta, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, author of the book Delaying Doomsday, The Politics of Nuclear Reversal, looking at Iran, the U.S., and negotiations over a nuclear weapons program in Iran. Rupal, this is not new technology. Nuclear weapons have been with us since 1945, basically. And the amazing thing in some ways is, contrary to a lot of fears early on, every country doesn't have nuclear weapons. I mean, in some ways, this is a non-proliferation success story over the past 7 or 8 decades, isn't it?
Absolutely. And in fact, it was President John F. Kennedy that was really concerned that we'd see, 100 plus countries with nuclear weapons. Thankfully, we have not seen that for the most part because these weapons are incredibly expensive. They take a lot of very high resourced countries with developed personnel skill sets to be able to operate them. That was one of the problems Libya had, is they didn't have the necessary personnel to actually develop and operate nuclear weapons. And third, the United States and other members of the international community have been very effective in stopping the spread of nuclear weapons through these negotiations and through these deals, whether or not it's through the creation of NATO to try to increase the defensive capability and deterrent power of European countries without them developing their own nuclear weapons, or through private military economic assistance, providing, for example, a defensive security agreement to countries in East Asia like Taiwan and Japan and South Korea. All three of those factors combined, I think, have made this truly a non-proliferation success story.
Looking at Iran, the U.S., and nuclear negotiations with Rupal Mehta from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Time for another caller. Andrew is with us in Waukesha. Andrew, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. So I don't claim to be an expert on the issue. I would like to hear the guests' opinions on what are the United States' options if Iran simply develops nuclear weapons. I mean, what incentive does Iran have? Because I don't see any evidence that the United States public is going to support drastic countermeasures against a country that has withstood invasion numerous times. And the last time I remember us doing it in the 70s was to rescue hostages. That ended in a complete failure.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Rupal, options, including military options. Andrew's wondering about if Iran just goes flat out and develops nuclear weapons.
That's certainly an option. I think it's probably the lowest likelihood and high risk option, in part because you definitely don't want to go and attack a country that has nuclear weapons in case they detonate. I think other options include increased sanctions, trying to bring leaders to the table, and at the worst case scenario, sort of what we're doing with North Korea is managing a nuclear state. I think that's the least preferred option for Iran. Certainly no policy maker or member of the policy community in the United States or elsewhere wants to see a nuclear Iran. But I think we are going to be faced with a very different prospect if we get there. Hopefully, these discussions, these talks in Vienna, the negotiations with the new administration, both in the United States and Iran, would avoid that potential. But we're dealing with a very dangerous and very different prospect if we do have Iran eventually go and develop nuclear weapons.
Thanks a lot for that call. Rupal, in just our last minute, what are you watching for next?
I'm looking for any signs of progress from the Vienna talks, especially given the most recent election. I'm looking for intelligence coming out of the IAEA and from other international organizations about where the Iranians actually stand in terms of their nuclear progress. And mostly, I'm just keeping my fingers crossed that we can have continued discussions of diplomacy so that we can avoid the fate that we're very worried about.
Rupal, thanks again for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That was Rupal Mehta, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and the author of the book Delaying Doomsday, The Politics of Nuclear Reversal. Been talking about Iran, the U.S., and nuclear negotiations. Coming up, do you still find your next favorite song by listening to the radio? We'll find out how algorithm-driven technology has changed what it's like to find new music, especially on streaming services like the Spotify's and Pandora's and YouTube's of the world. You can start the conversation right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. That's the song Knights of Sidonia in the background by the band Muse. It's one of many bands I've discovered years after they were cool, of course, when they came up on a streaming service. If you use music streaming platforms like Spotify or Pandora or YouTube, there's a good chance that the algorithm technology built into it has helped you find a new favorite artist or song. And while you can still browse a record shop and pick at random, there are cheaper, faster ways. The ways we search for and discover new music has changed quite a bit since the rise of the internet, not necessarily always for the better. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you discover new music to listen to? Do you use things like Spotify Weekly or YouTube recommendations? Do you get introduced to new artists or songs by friends or maybe on the radio? Or do you shop record stores for something cool and new? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeremy Morris is an associate professor in media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me again.
Can you talk, first of all, about how radically things have changed in the way people discover music these days?
Yeah, well, I think, you mentioned these services like Spotify and iTunes. I mean, the amount of music now that we have access to is great. But the worry, obviously, with having access to that much music is how do you find what you want to listen to or what you might like to listen to? So these services have gotten really good at trying to answer that question for you, and they've sort of positioned themselves as the ones who can uniquely solve that problem, right? We have all these recommendations for you, thanks to all this great technology we're building that can get you to hear a whole bunch of music you never would have been exposed to otherwise.
You and some of your colleagues around the country recently wrote about this, and you did your best to lift up the hood to look at the so-called artificial intelligence and the algorithms that go into those recommendations that we might see on these services. How much do we know about how that works?
Well, yeah, it's really hard to get a full sense of it because a lot of this stuff is proprietary technology. But, you know, there are enough accounts of how these things get built, and there are journalists who are doing a lot of really good work in terms of unearthing how specific practices work. But yeah, you know, I mean, you're looking at a huge combination in sites like Spotify that involve, you know, lots of technology at work, but also lots of people making decisions about what music, you know, should be featured on certain pages, on certain playlists, and all these different features that the services offer. So, you know, there are certainly a lot of technologies at play, but I also like to remind people that there are also always still a lot of humans involved in this process. So part of that report that we talked about was, you know, reminding people that AI, artificial intelligence, or that algorithms are not just technical things, right? They're also highly cultural. They're designed by people. They're created with certain biases in mind about what music means and how music should be discovered. So always thinking about both the technical elements and the cultural elements of algorithms or AI or any technology is important.
That's a point I want to dig into more, because we hear this with the use of algorithms in so many spheres of our lives these days, not just music suggestions. And this idea that, well, it's scientific, it's an algorithm, it's objective and unbiased. Can you talk about the human element and how it can really be more biased in some ways?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's any number of ways that bias creeps into the process. I mean, you can think about, you know, first of all, the amount of tracks that something like Spotify has access to, right? It may be a huge amount, but there's lots of musics that maybe are not represented on Spotify in the first place. So the algorithms aren't going to capture any songs that aren't being licensed to Spotify or that aren't represented by Spotify. But then also, you know, the people who design these algorithms, design these discovery features are designing them with a particular idea of what it means to listen to music in mind and what music is and what popular music is, right? So a lot of times that may not represent the wide variety of musical cultures that are around the world. So always kind of keeping that in mind when we think about how these algorithms work is pretty important.
Talking to Jeremy Morris from UW-Madison, Associate Professor in Media and Cultural Studies, looking at how we discover new music. It's changed a lot with the rise of various streaming services, all trying to help us find new music that fits into our already existing preferences and parameters. Love to hear your own examples. 800-642-1234 of how you have discovered music, past or present. Maybe going back to the old days. What's your memory of discovering a band that you came to love in a record store, on the radio, from a friend, in a movie soundtrack? Or how did you discover a song or an artist yesterday online? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeremy, I know another point of concern, and again, that you and your colleagues wrote about, is this idea that, okay, when I use these services, and I do, a picture is being painted of me, and it can allow people to sell things to me, for example. What kind of things do we know about what they know about me when I'm listening to their music?
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's a really interesting element of it, right? Like digitization of music, or the turning of music into these kind of streaming services, has really blown music up into millions of data points, right? So every time we, you know, press play, every time we press skip, every time we skip a track, you know, or we dislike a track or like a track, all those things are signals that get fed back into you know, their profile of us. And, you know, sometimes that profile works out, but other times that profile can get kind of messed up, right? Sometimes you're listening to Spotify with friends and you may be listening to songs that, you know, aren't your favorite. Sometimes your kids are listening and that can throw off the algorithms as well, right? So there's all these ways, but, you know, they, again, Spotify is reacting to this, and not just Spotify, but these music services in general are trying to like find that balance between, you know, what are honest and true signals that we are giving the system versus versus which ones might be noise. But, you know, that gets really tricky for a system like Spotify to parse. So anytime we're thinking about what shows up on our playlists or what's being recommended to us, right, we always sort of have that question, okay, why? Why is that being featured to me? Why is it telling me that I should be listening to that song or that band now?
Is this necessarily any better or worse, Jeremy, than, you know, well, once upon a time, this record executive determined what got recorded and produced and marketed in my area, or a radio station executive or a radio station computer in Cincinnati or whatever the case is? Is this different, better, worse? I don't know.
Right. I'm glad you pointed that, because there is certainly a long history of how music has been curated for us. Whether you talk about radio DJs, whether you talk about music producers or A&R reps, right? There are all these technologies and roles in which music gets kind of filtered before it comes to us. So in that sense, yeah, no, Spotify's algorithms are not necessarily different. What they do is they add kind of a new element to that, an element which I'd argue, you know, relies heavily, like you were saying, on personal data, on the giving up of kind of intensely personal details about our own kind of habits with listening to music. And so Spotify is really trying to kind of play on that element of it. Now, whether or not you find that invasive or extremely useful is going to depend on the kind of music consumer you are and your relationship with music in that way, right? So I wouldn't necessarily say it's any better. I'd say music has always come to us as a result of decisions that were partly made by people, but also, you know, decisions or factors that are filtered through the technology that music comes to us through, whether that's the CD, the cassette tape, the radio, right? Any of those things all have their own kind of mechanisms, again, for shaping how we understand music.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Cato. Jeremy, hi.
Hey, how you doing? So my comments are, you know, I definitely use the streaming services, but they seem to only, you know, suggest music that's at a, you know, a higher production value. And what I really miss is, you know, back when I was younger, going to check out live shows at places like Concert Cafe in Green Bay, where you'd maybe know one person playing or one band playing, and there'd be like three other bands, you know, and you'd leave with a new DVD or a new CD or a vinyl and, you know, some new music. It's really hard to try and find something new now if you're just using the, you know, Pandoras and things like that.
Jeremy, that's an interesting point. And guest Jeremy Morris, is there a threshold, you know, we're not going to discover that completely unheard of band in our streaming service?
I guess it depends. You know, it really, there's definitely, I'll definitely agree here that one of the things that is problematic about algorithmic recommendation is that you can fall into this loop of like, if I keep listening to the things that sound similar to what I like, then I'm going to keep hearing the same things recommended back to me, right? So we may, you know, our kind of recommendations may be kind of closed in terms of how they come to us, right? I do think, you know, these services do offer a huge amount of music. So, you know, with a bit of poking around and trying to listen to different things, you can start to hear those different recommendations come to you. And yeah, things like Spotify's Discover Weekly playlist start to do that. But yeah, do you miss the ability to find these you know, this kind of smaller or lesser known artists, right, that don't necessarily have the resources, don't necessarily get as many plays as some of the other bands, right? So I think there's still very much a question about like how Spotify as a global service provider interacts with like local music cultures and what you'd hear, like what Jeremy's describing about, you know, the local bands that may not necessarily be on Spotify or may not be, you know, huge and making a lot of noise on that, enough noise to get recommended onto playlists.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Jeremy Morris, Associate Professor in Media and Cultural Studies at UW-Madison. We're talking about how technology has changed the way we discover new music. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you find new music? Do you use a Spotify Weekly or other playlists generated by Spotify? Do you bounce around on Pandora or YouTube or iTunes or wherever you're getting your music from? Or do you have other ways to discover new stuff? Do you think technology has made it easier to find music you might otherwise have not heard, or does it just give you more of the same? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation and hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Jeremy Morris, Associate Professor in Media and Cultural Studies at UW-Madison. We're talking about streaming technology and how it's changed the way that we discover music. And we want to hear how you discover music at 800-642-1234. Do you remember the first time you heard a band that you love? Was it live at a show? Was it on the radio? Did a friend play it for you on an album or cassette tape or 8-track or CD, or was it streaming? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Ethan is with us in Avon. Ethan, hi.
Hey, how's it going? Just wanted to say that I think Spotify is pretty great. It is limited in certain aspects. I think your previous caller mentioned you get kind of pigeonholed into a really similar artists. For example, I listen to a lot of obscure types of music, progressive and technical math rock kind of music, and I listen to the more heavy side of things. My girlfriend likes the same bands, and she listens to a little bit of the lighter side, so between the both of us, we get recommended a really broad spectrum, but we both find things that each other would like that we might not have otherwise, you know, found. And also, we find a lot of bands that you just would never have heard about. You know, they have, like, 100 monthly listeners or something like that, and then that can, you can take that away and go follow them on their own pages and purchase their music from them directly. I think that's a great way to kind of bridge the gap between old industry and the new form of listening to music.
Ethan, thanks a lot for sharing that story. I appreciate it. Jeremy, but what do you think about Ethan's strategy?
Yeah, no, I think that's great, and I love that point at the end too of, you know, taking it beyond just, oh, I heard this band on Spotify and I like that song, and then, you know, forgetting about it, you know, the next week when we get a new list of recommendations, but, you know, following up, listening, you know, on their other kind of outlets they're participating in, going to the concert, right? Because that's when you also get that other kind of exposure of like, oh, I see the opening bands that opened for them, right? And I wouldn't be exposed to them either, right? So I think that's one of the great benefits and promises, certainly, of a service like Spotify is that they do have such a wide catalog that you would be recommended songs that you wouldn't necessarily run into every day, right? Whether or not that promise is always true for all listeners is a different question, but certainly, yeah, like the ability to do that and to find those gems that way can be very exciting.
Ethan, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. You can share your musical discovery voyages with us at 800-642-1234. Do you stream? How do you stream? How do you find new stuff? Or do you like other ways of discovering new music? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Torsten is with us in Chippewa Falls. Torsten, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. It's all nice to discover all this new music through those streaming services, but you only will be able to hear those musicians if they can make money, and most streaming services pay almost nothing to those musicians. I mean, the worst ones would be Pandora and YouTube, then maybe Spotify in the middle of the road, and the services that pay a bit better, it would be Tidal or and Napster. And the best thing is to buy still CDs from the musicians, because if you want to listen to good music, we have to make sure that musicians can make a living.
Torsten, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Jeremy, Torsten brings up an important point that you and I have talked about in past conversations. What does this all mean for the musicians, especially for the non-huge names, as Torsten was saying, who are hoping to make enough money to keep playing music?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you reminded me that we did talk, because I was like, I think we talked about this in an episode before. But yeah, you know, certainly the royalty structure for streaming services is extremely complicated. You know, artists get paid a percentage of the total streams, you know, so the actual amount that ends up going to an artist given, you know, in a given month or something like that can be quite minimal. I will also say that, you know, even though the CD might be a little bit more in terms of that, the royalty structure there, depending on their record contract, mm-hmm. is still quite out of whack. So, you know, it depends on the artist in terms of what the best way to support them is. You see, luckily now, a lot of new platforms that are trying to make the connection between your donation or your play or your money and the artist receiving that a little bit closer, right? So whether that's tip jars, whether that's straight up donations through some of the channels that they're now able to participate on social media are great ways. Live concerts are another good ways in most cases to support artists. So yeah, I completely agree with everything that's being said there, that's a highly problematic part of the streaming music economy. But again, you know, balancing that with the exposure that these services might offer to artists is something that I know at least some independent musicians find quite helpful.
Thanks for that call, Torsten. Also on the economic side of things, Jeremy, I always wonder, am I hearing this band because somebody paid for me to hear this band, whether a record label or the artists themselves? If a radio station did that, they used to call that payola, and people could go to jail for that. Is that something that's happening behind the scenes for streaming?
Right, and that's really hard to tell a lot of those things. Spotify used to run a feature called Spotlight, and it was a kind of promotion-type deal with independent artists. I'm not sure if they're running it still or if they've rebranded it. In fact, I think they did, because a few weeks ago I saw something in the news on it. But, you know, it was this service where, like, if you were seen to be an up-and-coming artist on Spotify, they would get in touch with you, and they, you know, through some kind of deal, they'd put you in a special part of their website and feature your songs in some playlists. But again, you know, a lot of that stuff that goes on in terms of how and who gets placed on what playlists is not totally transparent to us. So as a listener, definitely asking that question of like, how did that music get there? And is it just there because it sounds like other things that I listen to? Or is it there because, you know, somebody had a vested interest in making it get there? You also have, like you have with Google, you know, search engine optimization, you have companies and artists who get really good at trying to, you know, like play with the metadata of their songs, mess with the keywords in their song titles so that their songs show up in your searches in Spotify before other ones. So that's not necessarily like the person paid to be there, but they are trying to kind of game the system in a particular way.
Time for one more caller. Linda is with us in Rhinelander. Linda, hi.
Hi, how are you? I'm coming to you with a little bit of a different angle, I think, here, and possibly a different generation with a lot less technology in my life. But I religiously listen to CBS Sunday Morning, and they feature a new artist, a new group, or not necessarily new, but new to me. And they give that artist enough time that you can really find out if you like them or not. They interview them and they give them three or four songs to do in a segment. And if I like them and go, wow, I'd like to listen to that, I put them in Pandora and then I follow along with them on that. I really love it.
Linda, thanks a lot for that call. Jeremy, still people reaching out to different media to get their first taste of some artists.
Yeah, no, and I think that's fantastic. And I love the way Linda was talking about context there, right? Like mm-hmm. being able to get a bit of the context around the band for some listeners is really important to be like, do I want to invest in this band? Do I want to listen to them more? It's not just, did I like the music? It's like, you know, can I get a sense of the story behind the band as well? But yeah, you know, I think as sort of a closing thought on that, right? Like, if I want to use a bit of the language of algorithms and AI, right? Diversifying the inputs in terms of like how you get new music is always a useful procedure, I think, right? So don't just rely on one particular way of getting it, right? Don't just rely on Spotify's recommendations, right? Talk to your friends about music, you know, go into a record store every once in a while, right? There's all these different means through which, you know, turn on the radio, right? There's all these different means through which we can have songs kind of introduced to us. And I think kind of spreading that out as much as possible will kind of hopefully, you know, give you a bit of a wider exposure there.
Thanks for the call, Linda. It's just our last 30 seconds or so, Jeremy. Would you like to see more transparency for how these algorithms work so we know why we're getting what we're getting?
Yeah, I think more transparency, both in terms of how the algorithms work, but also in terms of, you know, like who's behind the algorithms, right? What are the ideas they have about music and about why they're building the things they're building, right? A lot of that stuff is very opaque to customers, very difficult to see. And so therefore, when we see that music, we're not entirely sure, you know, how it got there and why.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
Jeremy Morris is an associate professor in media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about how technology has changed the way we discover music. You can find a link to some research he's done at WPR.org/Central Time. And you could share your stories of how you discover music over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, Kate talks to the author of the new book, Fierce Self-Compassion, How Women Can Harness Kindness to Speak Up, Claim Their Power, and Thrive. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then President Biden made Juneteenth a federal holiday last week when he signed a bill from Congress into law. Talk to the writer who says the recognition falls short of what's really needed for Black Americans. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.